Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. Really excited today because we always seem, Zach, do we not, to somehow let the poor Jordan slide be like somewhere outside of our radar.
Yeah, but that's because, you know, Napoleon, Wellington,
World
men,
War stuff.
War,
yeah.
You know, all the stereotypes. I'm very sorry, but that's kind of what Marcus and I tend to do.
Yeah, it's bad. But we're rectifying it today, aren't we?
We are. We are. So we have Sarah Murden with us, who is going to basically complete our education as we discuss Georgian women who weren't really anything like what you might expect. Because we've got spies, we've got self-destructing letters, bogus journals, and one of the brains behind William Wilberforce. So to talk us all through it, we have, as I say, Sarah, who is a genealogist and a historian who co-runs the blog All Things Georgian and is co-author of a number of books of the period, including An Infamous Mistress, The Lives, Loves and Family of the Celebrated Grace Dalrymple Elliot, and All Things Georgian, Tales from the Long 18th Century. Sarah, how are you doing?
Thank you, and thank you very much for inviting me.
It's great to have you on.
Yeah, this could be really excited. Rarely do I see Zach get excited about something that doesn't involve Napoleonic warfare, but he was well chuffed with this one.
Excited because there's exploding or dissolving letters and things. That's the truth of it, isn't it, Zach?
See, if we don't get some kind of dodgy 007 reference in here, then, no, we failed.
Yeah. So, what do people expect of women in this period, Sarah? How deeply entrenched are the ideas of a public sphere for men and women just existing behind closed doors?
I think the public sphere is very much for the men. They were pretty much free to do what they liked within their social class. So, you know, for the upper class, it was hunting, shooting, fishing, running their estates, and basically, you know, living the life of Riley. For your average person, it was, or average man, it was working. A little wife would stay at home and raise the children. And if you're working class, she probably had to work as well. So I don't think it was a great life for women. If you were a woman in the upper class, then again, staying at home, running the house, looking the part and producing the heir and the spare. That was pretty much a woman's role.
What was the stigma like if you didn't fulfil that kind of, if you didn't fit into that box then?
Good question. I think for sort of working class women, I think you were taught by your parents that the expectation was that somewhere along the line you find a husband and you'd settle down and marry and have children and perpetuate the line. And I think that is what most women did. If they didn't marry and remained the sort of old spinster, then the expectation was that they would stay at home, look after the elderly parents, and just eke out their days doing whatever was required. In the upper classes, though, again, it was pretty similar. You were the old maid, the maiden aunt who was dragged along to every social event, and it was just sort of, oh dear, oh, that's a bit of a shame. You never married. It was that sort of view, really, of women.
So there's a contradiction here, isn't there? That if you're working class and a woman, you're expected to go out and work.
Yes.
But if you're from the upper echelons of society, if you were to do any work, that would be deeply frowned upon. How
yes.
do people kind of get their heads around that dumb contradiction?
I think it was just the way it was. Not the way that we were. I think the difficulty is that we can only understand what it was like from documents that have been written. And that there is very, very little written by your average woman of the 18th century or 19th century, come to that. So we can only learn from what memoirs and things like that have been left. So it's really difficult to judge, to be quite honest.
let's celebrate then, because this is kind of like, it's sad when you hear this, isn't it? It's just like, but this is the history of women, is being sort of secondary to men and being the adult. But let's celebrate women that said bugger that in the Georgian period. Let's talk about the life of Charlotte Biggs. And we should warn listeners, she does have a rough start, and she is exposed to the very worst that society can chuck at her. In the victim of abduction and sexual assault, is that right? You say she was taken hostage twice. Who is she, and how does she end up being taken hostage?
Right, okay. So, yes, bugger to that. Charlotte, as she preferred to be known, her proper name was Rachel Charlotte. So she kind of defied convention from the start. Her parents named her Rachel Charlotte, but no, she was going to be Charlotte. She was... Gosh, she was a woman that lived life on her own terms. We first came across her when we were doing some research for another book, and we came across a place that doesn't exist anymore in Fulham, which was Peterborough House, and that was owned by the Earl of Peterborough and his wife. And whilst we were looking for that, we were trawling through newspapers, and there was a mention of a suspected rape. And we thought, oh, right, okay, let's try and find out more about it. And it turned out it was a servant girl who had either had been raped or had cried rape, which counted for very little at that time. And basically she just fled. End of story. But we didn't let it go at that. We kept sort of trawling around, sort of Google and things like that, trying to find out more, you know, using every search term we could think of for rape, abduction, hostage, Peterborough House. And eventually we came across a document by the author and poet Mariusz Kozidziałski, who, if you don't know his work, he's worth checking out. And he had come across what was called a testament, in other words, an account of a woman that was written in 1821. And she was basically, it's all a bit mysterious because there's Mr. H underscore, and his name's left blank. Mr. B underscore, name left blank. Anyway, Marius did a lot of digging to try and work out what on earth this document was all about, and eventually worked out that the document was a letter or a testament written to Sir David Ochterlony, who was a really sort of bigwig out in India. And it was written to him from the first love of his life. And that was Charlotte. And what she was doing, basically, was writing an account of, well, you've cleared off to India, left me on my own. I'll update you on what's happened in the past, 30 years since you went away. And in this testament, she tells him all about the fact, well, after you'd gone, you might want to know, and it's all kind of nicely phrased and everything, that Mr. H, who we can only assume Ochterlony would have known what the H stood for, Mr. H abducted me, took me to his house, and assaulted me and kept me a prisoner there. Not, as you say, not once, but twice. The first time was at his property in, or just near the House of Commons, just near Westminster Bridge. And she eventually managed to escape from there. She was obviously quite an astute, I mean, bear in mind, she was only, what, sort of 20 at the time. But she kind of played for time, and she asked for some books and some needles and thread. And she basically tore out pages from the book and formed a message, which via the apothecary who visited the house, she managed to sneak it to him. He got it to a friend of theirs, a family friend. And having done that, they sent a carriage for her and took her home. So, you know, she wasn't short on brains in terms of trying to figure out how to actually make her escape. So she went home, you know, looking completely dishevelled and just, you know, complete sort of skeleton, really. Was home for a while, and then he managed to abduct her for a second time.
What is wrong with this guy?
And he was obsessed with her. He was absolutely and utterly obsessed with her. I'm not going into the details are in the book. So I'll kind of spare listeners that. But he was obsessed with her. He just wanted her, and he wanted to keep her, and couldn't sort of get into his head that the way to win a woman's heart was not to abduct her and to hold her hostage. Doesn't work and didn't work.
So he does.
Having failed once, he tried again.
I was going to say, so he does do it again.
And yeah.
What happens to him? Does anything happen to him? She gets away again, doesn't she?
Yeah, she eventually, yeah, she got away from him eventually, and she went off to a convent in France, presumably to recuperate from it all. What happened to him? He found somebody else and married a few months later, as if it had never happened, and he was...
No jail time or anything?
No.
Zach's got his head in his hands. It's just like, so it's okay. Do just, if you want a woman, just steal her twice, and then nothing will happen to you.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what he did. Women were commodities to men at that time. They had about as much importance as your horse or your dog. You could just use them, and in this case, you could use them and abuse them. And if you think about the likes of Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, who ended up spending her marriage in a menage a trois.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, she didn't behave as she was expected to behave. And hubby just sort of thought, oh, well, you know, I'll just take a lover. Oh, and she can move in. Oh, and by the way, you can stay as well.
Well, that's a child for you to raise as well.
Yeah.
Before that, if that happened, it was in the film.
Well, the daughter, the reason for the sort of interest in her as well is that the child, if you remember from the film, she's left with, or he presents her with a sort of 5 or 6 year old child to raise. What did she say? He said something like, it will be good practice for you for when you have a child to basically get on and rear her. Mm. And my mind working the way it does, I thought, I wonder what happened to that girl. So on the All Things Georgian blog, there is what became of her on there. So I kind of can't let go of things like that. I was just so incensed by the fact that anybody could actually do that. And I don't think that film's terribly far away from the true situation. And then you've got people like Seymour Worsley, Lady Worsley. And she was another one that she ended up having affairs while her sort of lecherous husband was being a voyeur and watching her. So I think he instigated a lot of that. So it wasn't a great time to be a woman, but it was a great time to be a man, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, all of the parallels with it when, you know, you look at crime and all these things as a researcher, and you come across this kind of stuff in spades, and the number of instances where wealthy men took advantage of, to use a hugely kind of over euphemistic term, domestic servants, particularly if they had to live in as part of their duties, it's just horrendous. And it just goes to show that actually very little has changed at a kind of fundamental level in terms of attitudes to women in the last kind of 200 years.
Yeah, and I think sort of the recent news sort of confirms that, doesn't it, in a way?
Doesn't it, just?
Have we moved on? Women didn't feel safe in the 18th century, and do they feel safe today?
You found, though, when you were looking at Charlotte Biggs, that she completely reinvented herself, didn't she? How did she end up organising King George III's Golden Jubilee?
Oh, absolutely, she invented herself. I think maybe the period of time in the convent gave her thinking time, which is perhaps what she needed. But she came back to England, and she was a great one. The reason we know a reasonable amount. There are still an awful lot of unanswered questions about her and her life and how much of what she said was true. But she was a great one for letter writing. She just kept writing letter after letter after letter. She trying to put her sort of social class together is really, really difficult. She wasn't working class and she wasn't in the upper echelons. She was somewhere, I guess, what we'd call middle class. But she knew people. She knew men in influential positions. And I don't think she knew them from any other reason than perhaps they were acquainted with her father or something like that. And she was a real royalist. And she took it upon herself to decide that something needed to be done to commemorate George III's Golden Jubilee. So what am I going to do? How am I going to make this thing happen? I know. I'll sit down and I'll write letters to each of the town leaders. So she sat down and she, for example, she'd write to, say, Nottingham. And she'd say, George III's Golden Jubilee in October of 1809. Maybe you'd like to do something to commemorate it. So why don't you organise a feast for Nottingham? And then she'd write another one to, say, Lincoln. I understand that Nottingham are going to be holding a feast for George III. Maybe you'd like to do something like organise a feast and organise fireworks. Oh, right, okay, so that's got Nottingham and Lincolnshire involved, or counties or districts or whatever. And then she'd write to Yorkshire. Nottinghamshire and Lincolnshire are holding feasts and fireworks. Wouldn't it be good if you had church services and hog roasts? And she just perpetuated this until she'd got over 1,000 letters written. But she was clever because she was, at the time, she was living just outside Chepstow. So she'd go into, which is not too far from Bristol, so she'd catch the coach to Bristol. Because she was so private, she said, I'm not going to post them from Chepstow, because it could be traced back to me. I'll post them from Bristol. But she didn't send them out from Bristol. She sent them from Bristol to London, to a friend who worked in Parliament, and they then sent them on to, it was basically, so in other words, it was going out from the government, not from this little lady, middle-aged lady who was living in, the outer reaches of Chepstow. And eventually virtually all the towns around the country joined in with this celebration, doing feasts, church services, fireworks. She even got commemorative medals organised as well. So she kind of, it took a lot of thinking, a lot of planning. Can you imagine trying to do that today as a one person?
Did it get traced back to her?
No, the reason we know about it is because it was a few years later, and I think she was slightly on her uppers by then, and she wrote to an MP that she knew, basically telling him how much she'd forked out for organising this, and like, is there any chance of some reimbursement for all these letters and postage that I've already spent on your behalf? And they paid her. So she was clever. And she got Princess Elizabeth, one of George III's daughters, involved, and was given a gift of this writing desk as a thank you present for all her hard work and everything. And that becomes fairly crucial right at the very end of her life. Or no, after her death. So yeah, she was quite a woman doing that, really.
Have I got this right? She ends up being one of the ladies who influences William Wilberforce.
Yes. Yes, she did. As I said, she was a great one for letter writing. She wrote to everybody and anybody in Parliament that would take any notice of her. And what she was doing was, by the time William Wilberforce sort of was aware, or not, he wasn't aware of her as such. But she had been going backwards and forwards to France, finding out what France was like, what the current situation was, and writing up notes and things like that and sending them back. And she was also, I mean, she, for a woman at that time, she took a great interest in not necessarily politics in terms of who was in control and things like that, but how it was affecting the people of the country. And at that time, there was quite a degree of sort of poverty, and she wrote to William Wilberforce about the cost of grain. And it was, she mentioned it in one of her letters to somebody else. And it was when you actually check back to the House of Commons in 1800, it was regarding the high price of provisions. And he actually, he said that he was referencing a letter from a man who had been in France. But it wasn't a man, it was her. But basically, by doing it that way, by saying it was from a man in France, one thing I haven't told you is there was a Mr. Biggs who was her, well, we can only call him a companion, because there's no evidence that they married, but she adopted his surname of Biggs and added that to the end of her Rachel Charlotte Williams. And she and Mr. Biggs were travelling around France. But we can't really figure out exactly what he was doing. We suspect he was a spy, but we don't know. But if he wasn't, he was a great cover for what she was doing. So it gave her respectability by being Mrs. And it gave her the cover she needed to be a woman travelling around France. So it was, she wrote this letter to Wilberforce and he read it out, and that was sort of it really. But she was in regular contact. Her main contact was Nicholas Vansittart, who was the treasurer of the Exchequer at the time, and she wrote lots of letters. He knew all about what she was doing, and I was actually, when I was sort of thinking about what we were going to talk about, I actually had a look at her her accounts and everything again, and he funded her travelling around France. And I'm a bit short of money, and this is going to cost me this, and this is going to cost it. You can see where I'm going with this, can't you? So she's like, I'm not going to be able to afford to do all of this travelling around and looking at what's going on. Do you think there's any chance of me having some money? I was looking at her accounts. It actually translates to about £20,000 in today's money.
She's brilliant. I like her.
We absolutely loved her. But we're infuriated by her in equal measure, because it's like anything you read. There's two sides to every story. But we were... Is she telling the truth? Isn't she telling the truth? Like, really difficult to know how much was fiction and how much was fact. But the writing desk actually holds some of the key to that. But I'll leave that bit with you to think about. So she goes off to France. You were saying at the beginning about the James Bond moments. Nodding your head there. She's travelling around France, and it was about 1816, something like that. And she'd been out and returned sort of early evening in a carriage with a servant and a coachman. And it was dark, so she waited in the coach whilst the servant went in to unlock and to get a light. And as she's sitting there, the coachman is sitting up on his seat, but somebody just suddenly throws something into the carriage and then speaks to her in English, but she said he was obviously French, basically saying, open this when you're alone. And then he just disappears, leaving her kind of with this package to open. So she gets back to her room, and she lights a fire and she lights the candles and everything. And she sort of looks at the package, doesn't really know what to make of it. And inside there's a square of parchment and a couple of envelopes and some paper, which is a sort of yellow colour. So she opens all of this up and she starts to read it. And the reader, when she reads it, it's a warning. It's basically telling her to get out of France, but she's in danger. Whoever it is respects her. Stay calm, do nothing, just get yourself out of there. So whoever it was obviously expecting either she'd blown her cover, or something was going to kick off and she wasn't going to be safe. And then 2 minutes later, she's sitting there away from the fire, away from the candle, and the paper just spontaneously combusts.
Zach looks sceptical.
Well, we were. The only reason that we're not is because we did some more research into it, and it wasn't unusual for that to happen. And also, that's quite a tall tale to be telling the Chancellor of the Exchequer, which is exactly what she did. She wrote to him and said, this is exactly what's happened. Get me out of there. And
did
so
he
she came back to England.
Did he get her out of there?
Yep, she came back to England. But it was around that sort of time that a General Sarrazin, who was one of Napoleon's generals, he fled from France. When he arrived in England, he created a bit of a stir because he wanted money from the British government. But he was put in effectively a safe house, which would mean probably very little to anybody, but it was on Frith Street, which is it's actually next door to, you've heard Ronnie Scott's jazz club. It's next door to there. It's only when you know that Rachel Charlotte's father owned that property, it was basically being used as a safe house.
Wow, she's in deep, isn't she?
She is in deep, definitely. You know, I mean, I suspect that, you know, in due course, that more information will come out about her. You know, but it's not going to, it's not like, well, I can't say it won't, but I don't think it's going to be anything that she's told anybody. I think it's going to be in letters that will appear that, you know, either she's either been mentioned in or, but she played everything so close to her chest. She really didn't, she was a private woman. She didn't want, the public acclaim for organising the Golden Jubilee. She didn't want anything, really. She just wanted to do right by her country. That, I think, to me, that's what makes her absolutely amazing.
Do we know... go on, Zach.
See, are you about to tell us that this whole writing desk thing centres around some kind of hidden nook inside it where there's secret information or something, or she's got like the equivalent of a cyanide capsule or something hidden away?
You wish. No, there's papers in there which confirm something.
Tell us. Come on, you've got it. You can't leave us hanging.
No, it's in the book.
I've
got to save something, haven't I?
Indeed. Let's move on to I Love Her. If you want to find out what was in that writing desk and what became of her, you are going to have to buy the book because Sarah's not going to tell us. But she's also written about a pretty incredible woman by the name of Grace Dalrymple Elliott. What is her story? She ends up with an illegitimate child. I'm just looking because it says
George the Fourth.
George the Sixth. And I'm like, what? Bertie? No. The wrong way around. I was like, no, I refuse to believe it. Not my Bertie.
He had literate.
God, and then then I'm thinking equally, who'd want to have an illegitimate kid with that dick? But she did, didn't she?
Well, yes. But you've got to bear in mind that he wasn't very old at the time.
Who was she and how does this come about?
Right. Okay, Grace. She became the bane of our life for several years, trying to trace her story. So she's a few years older than Charlotte, but not much. She was born sort of 1753. She's born in Scotland, got a couple of brothers and a sister. The book is really, it's trying to put into context, her life into context, really, because there's been a lot written about Grace. a lot of it wrong. I will start with that bit. So we just started piecing it all together and trying to look at her, I suppose, as we thought she ought to be looked at, which was in the round, you know, with her family and what made her do the things that she did. Because she seemed very much as this high-class courtesan who, yeah, you're right, had a trial with George the Fourth, not the Sixth.
That blew my world.
Would have been quite an achievement.
Yeah.
But yeah, Grace, I mean, when it was pretty, I think she had a pretty tough upbringing, but from an affluent family. But her parents split up. She's left with mum and a sister and two brothers in Scotland. Father disappears off down to England, and I think at one point ends up as, I've forgotten what he was now, Governor General out in the Caribbean. So, you know, they were quite a well-to-do family, and certainly a Scottish family were. Her mother died when she was about 14, and so she's left to be raised by her aunts in Scotland, who are feisty. They're feisty Scottish women who took no prisoners. So I think she was quite, you know, I think she could stand on her own two feet, let's put it that way. But Dad takes her down, drags her down to London to marry this Dr. John Elliott, who is a much older man and quite boring. So this was kind of like the marriage made in hell. She's young, high-spirited, wants to go out enjoying herself. He's a sort of well-known, well-respected doctor. She ends up having an affair. You know, she got bored with him and had an affair. I think that was sort of... But at that time, women couldn't have affairs. Fine for men to have affairs, but not for women. So because she had an affair, he divorced her. And is the short version of that story.
And that's moving. Look at him.
It's too much for you, Zach.
The listeners are probably glad this is a radio show and not a.
Well, they can't see you.
Can't see you.
Oh dear. You see, you can't make it up. That's the thing.
So he divorces her.
He divorces her. So she's left to kind of live on her wits. She was glamorous. I mean, there's a couple of portraits of her that exist. Needless to say, they're over in America now, not here in Britain, which is bad. But she was, her nickname was Dally the Tall, because she was taller than your average woman. She was about 5'7", I think, in comparison to 5'1", 5'2". She was regarded as a beauty in her day. She ended up becoming a courtesan or high-class escort because she needed to work. She needed to earn money. And that was a way of doing it by getting men to support her and to look after her. So she began, then she ended up having an affair with the Marquis of Cholmondeley, who, I don't know really with that, it was one of those on-off relationships. So I don't quite know how that came about or really what the point of it was, to be quite honest, because they seemed to fall out. But their falling out was public. It was all in the newspapers. It was all the scandal and gossip of the day. And she was in the newspapers every day. So in terms of trying to piece her life together, it wasn't exactly difficult on that level because effectively she was tabloid fodder. Everybody wanted to know what she was wearing, who she'd been with, what parties she'd been at. You know, so it was easy. It was kind of easy press really for them. So she's with Marquis of Cholmondeley, who, if you ever want to check him out, there was a poem written about him and it was described as the torpedo or the electric eel. I'm not going to elaborate on that, but you can probably imagine what they were referring to.
I'm Googling him already.
Don't blame you. But he was supposed to be well endowed, let's put it that way. Anyway, this on-off relationship, they'd had enough of each other, or one way or the other, which we don't know. So she went off to France, and she began a relationship with the Duke of Orleans before being enticed back, apparently at the request of Prinny, future George IV, had a brief fling with him, and the result was a daughter. And she went on to marry into the Cavendish Bentincks, people who own Welbeck Abbey in Nottinghamshire. But that's another book that has its own story.
So at what point does she end up in France? Because she's out there during the revolution, somehow manages to keep her head, unlike a lot of nobles at this point. But then I think I've got this right, that she was also allegedly a spy, like Rachel Charlotte. So what kind of similarities are there between the two of them?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, you're right. I mean, Grace, she had the child. She went the child was raised by Cholmondeley. So Grace then goes back to France during the French Revolution. And this is where she writes her journal, My Life During the French Revolution. Some of which is fact, and we've kind of trawled through line by line by painful line. Could she have been there? Could she have been in this prison? I think a lot of it is true, but not all of it. But she was spying for the government, and she was writing, and basically she was writing to her little daughter who was being raised by Cholmondeley. And it's in all likelihood what was happening was while she was, you know, it's a letter to a little girl, but within that was information being passed back to the government. That's as far as we can understand it. So, yeah.
Another one of your women is Dido Elizabeth Bell. This one's interesting. She was mixed race. So what was life like for her as a woman of colour? Who was she? Where did she come from?
Where did she come from? Well, that's the million-dollar question. We still don't know where Dido was born. But she was... Well, I don't know where she was born. We are 99% certain she was born here in England. But her mother was a slave. And... it was a slave ship that was captured by Sir John Lindsay, and she was pregnant. Well, there were two cats. Her mother was pregnant with Dido and gave birth to her in England, according to one account. And another account says she arrived here when she was a small child. So we know she was baptised in London in 1766. But there's no age, so we're not 100% certain. But Sir John Dido's the eldest, but he fathered five children in total. The other four were fathered while I was out in the Caribbean. And one died in infancy, one we have no trace of at all, apart from her baptism. And the other two, he brought back to the UK, and they were raised in Scotland. But Dido is raised at Kenwood House by Lord William Murray. So she led a very different life to what you would probably expect.
So she ends up living with Murray, Lord Mansfield, who famously claimed that slavery did not exist in common law. This is the guy, for folks who aren't aware, who's tied up in the Zong case about the slaves being thrown overboard allegedly in order to save the ship's supplies, but in actual fact it was an insurance scam. So in other words, Mansfield's ruling basically says that slavery can only exist if there was an actual piece of legislation explicitly saying and permitting slavery to exist. And that in itself was a major boost for the abolition movement. Is there any sense of Mansfield being influenced by the fact that he's got Dido living with him?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it, really? How could he, in a way, how could he not be influenced? Would be my take on it. If you ignore Dido's colour, she's a little girl being raised in your house, being treated, as far as we can tell, as far as documents show, you know, she's given money on her birthday, she's given money at Christmas, she's being raised as a gentlewoman, I suppose, at the time. Bring into that her ethnicity, I just don't see how he couldn't have been influenced. But whether, how much he let that impact on his ruling, that would only be for him to know. You know, he never wrote down, you know, I make this ruling because I have a child living with me who is not white. You know, there wasn't, it was never as explicit as that, really. But I think you've got to have been influenced.
You've mentioned that some of these women become the bane of your life to a certain extent, because this is really, we've had talks on here about trying to, forget her name, hang on, I'll cut this. We've had Miranda Kaufman on talking about her book Black Tudors and about how taking sort of one fragmentary suggestion of someone's existence and something interesting about their story and trying to reconstruct their life around it is really quite difficult. And I think it's still the case in this time period as well, says the spoiled 20th century historian who's got stuff everywhere. How do you find these women's stories? How do you add to them? And what's the craziest place you've been to try and add to some of these stories?
Oh, there's a question. How do we find them? God only knows. we don't go looking for them. I think honestly, the one of the books that we've written, which is The Right Royal Scandal, which effectively follows on from Grace, was our sort of starting point. And that was a throwaway comment that Jo made whilst we were looking for something, we were researching something completely different. And she just said, oh, you heard about the Romany girl that married into the aristocracy? I'm like, no, that can't possibly be true. And that started us looking, trying to find out whether there was any truth in that story, which there was, sort of. No, there was truth. There was truth. It was a gypsy girl who married into the Cavendish Bentinck family. She died and then he remarried, and our present queen is one of his descendants. We didn't go looking for that story. It kind of found us. And having found that, led us back a couple of generations to Grace. And researching Grace's story led us to Peterborough House. And Peterborough House led us to Rachel Charlotte. And then our latest book, which is about the Dukes of Bolton, there was a Mrs. Brown who was the mistress to one of the Dukes. And that's what led us to that, because Grace's mother's maiden name was Brown. And this woman seemed to mix in the same circles. So we don't go looking for them. They find us. And it's true on the All Things Georgian blog. I can sit there sometimes and think, what am I going to write? And I'll start looking in the newspapers, and I'll be looking for something in particular, and then something just grabs my attention. And it's like, oh, that's interesting. And then I just start to research more and more and more. You asked me about the most unusual.
I found myself stumbling around graveyards in the middle of nowhere thinking, how has this become my life? Have you had one of those moments?
Oh, I've done that. I've done that. I'll carry on doing weird things like that. The most unusual is actually with Rachel Charlotte's story. And that kind of will give Zach another clue. You see his face now. It's like, oh. I wrote to the Royal Archives just to see whether, I was trying to confirm this desk of Rachel Charlotte. And I wrote to them and I didn't get a reply. And I thought, oh, how rude. Anyway, put it all to one side and we carried on with what we were doing. And it was a few months later and we got a reply back saying, really sorry for not replying. But we do have some correspondence here, but it's not from Mrs. Biggs, it's from Mr. Biggs. I don't suppose it's anything to do with what you're researching. Anyway, I said, oh, yeah, it is. I said, thank you. Can you send it over and I'll take a look at it? And that gives me the clue to the writing desk. So it was kind of like the most unusual piece of research because it was months after we'd almost finished writing the book.
And this piece of research.
Sorry?
It's going to drive me mad until I can get my hands on this book. If our listeners want to learn...
Other than that, I think it's got to be trawling through French parish records, looking for people. I think that's probably the weirdest thing I've done. When you try, my French is equivalent to schoolgirl and very little more, and trying to sit and read through and determine whether it's a birth, a marriage, a death, and who it is and when it was and things. I think that's probably, it's been the most time consuming, if nothing else.
If our listeners want to learn a bit more about this topic, tell them where they can start and, importantly, tell them about your blog and your books and where they can get hold of them.
Right. I mean, I would say if you don't know anything about the 18th century, or even if you do, a bit of a self-plug, I guess, is to actually just Google all things Georgian. It's probably a good starting point because it's aimed at anybody and everybody, and the stuff from all over the country, and men and women. So it's not a female blog or anything. So I think it's probably a good starting point. We try to keep it as easy reading as possible, so anybody can just sort of dip into it. They're blog posts, so they're only kind of 1,500 words, something like that. So it's a dip in, dip out. And then if something interests you, then basically take it from there and start reading up. There are plenty of 18th century books out there to get your teeth into. But there's over 600 posts on there, so it's probably you should find something out there if you want to learn more about the 18th century. The books, our publisher is Pen and Sword, and I'd say they're on Amazon and all good retailers.
This has been brilliant. Thank you so much, Sarah. I want to go away now and write a book about spying in the Georgian period and basically completely shatter the whole 007 macho mindset and basically write a book about female spies.
There were other female spies out there. There's the, Helen Maria Williams. She was the, what do they call her? The Petit Matelot, little sailor. And she was a spy. She worked for the famous spy master. Rachel Charlotte wasn't the only one out there. Along with Grace, but in very different ways. Women can do other things other than just look like a clothes horse, which is what they were expected to look like in the 18th century.
Absolutely. Amen to that. Thanks very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Elena and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join... There's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hack history, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.